disruption zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
It's the Disruption Zone solo version. I have some statistics I want to go over on the coronavirus thing and a couple of issues that I want to address. First of all, I've been ringing the economic bell pretty hard, warning about the economic consequences of the total shutdown and for how long. It depends on how long it goes, how bad it could get. I am not against social distancing, nor was I against a maybe 2-3 week, you know, full on do what we're doing right now. The problem that I have is that government officials at all levels, from Mayor McBike Lane to Governor McDreamy, all the way up to President Trump himself, are not talking about the exit plan. The president did for a while, and then he got slapped down by the media, and he kind of went back into cover my ass mode and put another 30 days, tacked another 30 days onto this. Now, what's actually happening here is that the mainstream media recognizes that with a faltering economy, that's the best way to defeat Trump in 2020. Therefore, they are holding, the mainstream media is holding the nation hostage, the politicians hostage, to a very specific set of reactions to this virus. And if you veer from that in any way, shape, or form, they will attack. And that's what happened when President Trump said, you know, by the Easter, we could probably start maybe reopening the country. And the media was like, if you do, you'll be blamed for every death that happens thereafter. So we're in this for the long haul, because no matter when they decide to actually lift these restrictions and let you go back outside, from that point forward, every politician in America knows that the mainstream media will blame them for every death beyond that point. So that has governors and mayors and politicians of all stripes up and down the political ladder in America concerned and scared, not about actual lives, but about their political careers. And so we're stuck. We're stuck in this for the long haul until the media gets tired of playing with this sort of dead mouse, which is what used to be our economy. Our economy is now the dead mouse that the media is playing with. And when they realize eventually that this sort of over-restrictive situation for an ongoing period of time that no one knows how long it is actually going to kill the economy, potentially topple the country, maybe then they'll come to their senses and realize that more people are going to be killed from the economic devastation from this than from the virus itself. And if you don't believe me, I actually have a story that came out in Reuters today that, and let me just say this too. I have to caveat this. If you're listening to this podcast 30 days from now, all of what I'm saying may be absolutely stupid. So I understand the world in which we're living. I'm doing a podcast, which means it's up there forever in the recorded form, versus a live broadcast, which most of the media gets to just report stuff and then everybody forgets about. So with the full understanding that if you're listening to this podcast, say on May 30th, and everything is rosy and hunky-dory, this podcast looks pretty stupid. I'm only analyzing what sits right in front of me right now and the numbers that we have right now. And Reuters came out with a story that said researchers are warning that the COVID-19 lockdown will take its own toll on health. And let me just read a little bit from the Reuters piece, because it's really interesting. Well, I won't read a little bit, but I'll just give you kind of a synopsis. They mentioned, actually, this is a paragraph from the story. The longer the suppression lasts, history shows the worse outcomes will be. There was apparently a surge of unemployment in 1982, and that cut American lifespans by a collective 2 to 3 million years, according to researchers. During the last recession, 2007 to 2009, a bleak job market helped spike suicide rates in the United States and Europe, and that claimed the lives of more than 10,000 people. Now, that's interesting because, again, this comes from Reuters, but they sort of went through and detailed. There was a report by researchers at the Imperial College of London helped set the global lockdown in motion, contending that the coronavirus could kill, according to Reuters, 2 million Americans and 50,000 people in Great Britain unless governments rapidly deploy severe social distancing measures. So everybody freaked out. Now we have numbers that we're saying that this could kill 200,000 Americans. And now there's even experts refuting that. Anyway, the point that the Reuters article was making was that there will be a spike in domestic violence, that students will be vulnerable and face challenges to learning and fully reaching their potential. There'll be soaring suicides, as I mentioned. Public health system could be crippled, which could lead to more deaths from other types of diseases that aren't related to the coronavirus. There could be job loss mortality. This is from the Reuters article. Rises in unemployment during large recessions can set in motion a domino effect of reduced income, additional stress, and unhealthy lifestyles, and so on and so forth. So this is interesting because I've been ringing this bell from the beginning, saying this could kill more people than the disease does. Now, I get it. The disease is an actual event versus maybe some of these you could consider externalities, right? Like, we don't know the chain of events. The point is that long-term shutting Americans out of work and putting them in their house and putting them under house arrest is going to have crippling damage to our economy and to our lives and our livelihood. I wrote a piece this morning on Facebook. Let me pull it up here because I think it's worth repeating, because one of the things is I've been ringing this economic bell and I've had a bunch of people have come out on Twitter and they're like, you don't care about life because you care more about your wallet than your life. And anybody who brings up the economic side, you'll get that pushback from people who want to keep their head buried in the sand. And I pointed this out, the government today, and again, if you're listening to this in 30 days, this is irrelevant, but today the government is reversing its course on wearing masks in public. Originally, the government, literally the experts and doctors and scientists that we've been watching on TV for days, mocked and made fun of people who were wearing masks who weren't actually sick. And they dismissed the idea that it would help you. And this didn't make any sense to a lot of people. They're like, wait a minute. If a mask cuts down on anything, it cuts down on particles going into your face. It doesn't make sense that we wouldn't need it. Well, I happen to think that early on they saw us buying up all the toilet paper and the government was like, look, we need these masks for medical workers. If we tell them they need masks, they're going to buy them all and we won't have them for the medical workers because they just did that with the toilet paper. So let's lie and let's tell them they don't need the masks so that we can keep the masks for the workers until we get enough masks that then everybody can have one. That's, I think, what happened, right? There again, we trust this government, right? This is something I wrote on Facebook this morning about that mask story. The same government, doctors and experts that mocked and shamed people who were not sick for wearing masks is now about to tell you to wear one. And we gave up our freedoms and prosperity based on this government's recommendations. When this is over and people go outside and Americans see the real extent of the economic devastation, it will be interesting to see how we react. We had it really good. The economy was the best in my lifetime, best we've ever seen it, perhaps the best ever. Everyone in America was living their hashtag best life on Instagram with their yoga pants and their little Insta shots. All of that is gone now. And depending on who wins the upcoming election, that may be gone forever, or at least for a generation. I mean, this is not, as Congressman Massey told us, we don't recover from this in 3 months. We do not recover from this in 3 months. The landscape has changed. You're in home right now, and everything seems the same. But when you go back outside and that landscape looks entirely different, what is the reaction going to be? Look around the country. Is it really prudent that we have the same lockdown measures in, say, Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Butt Fork, Tennessee, or Oklahoma, or wherever, as we have in New York? And I'll give you some explanations for that in just a minute with some actual numbers. And my answer is no, we shouldn't have the exact same. Social distancing nationwide, yes. Maybe a short shutdown nationwide, couple weeks, yes. But other places have got to start reopening for business if they're not having devastating consequences from this virus. Now, and I'm not saying social distancing isn't wise, because it clearly is. But when we are finally able to go back outside and we realize there's no place to go because all the businesses are bankrupt and no one has a job, we're going to want our stuff back. We're going to want to go back and take selfies on our little vacations to tropical islands again, but we won't have any money to do that. We're going to want our stuff back. The people who accuse those of us who rung the economic warning bells about not caring about life will suddenly be searching for someone else to blame for the loss of their own retirement and lifestyle and the pain and suffering they're going through. And it will be fascinating to watch who they go after then. I'm saying all of this to point out that here's Reuters coming along, backing up my point. Now, do I think we need to lift all of these things right now today? No. I think if we did, we'd have a wider spread of the virus. I am on board with the idea of lowering the top of the curve and extending it out a little bit. I get what we're doing. But here's what Governor McDreamy and President Trump need to be talking about. They need to be setting benchmarks, and this is how this should look. Let's say right now it's April 2nd. In 2 weeks, we should be at a point where we have enough respirators, or let's say it's 3 or 4 weeks, whatever it is. May 1st, by May 1st, we should have enough respirators to handle hospital capacity in the hotspot areas. And these respirators are mobile and can move to additional areas as it becomes necessary. We'll have enough testing in place that we can say to businesses, you can open up as long as you test your employees weekly and you test their temperature, take their temperature, thermal temperature every single day, and show us a plan for how you'll keep your customers 6 feet apart. Show us those two things and you can reopen business and we can let healthy young people back out and to work. A tapered release system. Then we can say to the elderly and the people with immune compromised systems, guys, might want to hang on just a little bit. We're going to do some other things first. Then we get those respirators and we get the hospital bed capacity and the staff capacity and the PPE for the hospital workers. And then we can let them out if they want. And so we do a tapered release. And let's say that comes in May 1st, we do the first round, and on May 15th, we do the second round. Or June 1st, we do the second round. The point is we start to open for business May 1st. And if we have to slide those dates back because we're not meeting those numbers, fine. But you've got to give people and businesses some level of optimism, some level of hope that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. You can't just leave this open-ended. Because right now, if you listen to the conflicting numbers that we get from these people coming out of the White House and every other place, what you hear is, we're in this for 2 years, period. Do you think America will survive 2 years of lockdown, even if they let us out for a month or two at a time and then put us back in our house? Do you think that's even possible? So let me give you some statistics. I have a friend who's working on a doctorate, a PhD in social sciences. And he sent me some numbers this morning, and I'm going to go through these. And most of these he backed up with links. I am not a scientist. He admittedly is not a scientist, but he's studying social sciences, and these are some numbers that we have. And I just want to give you a couple of them. As of today, 1.2 million people tested, about 240,000 positive cases, about 18.8% of all tested confirmed positive. Now, that's the number of people tested. And out of the number of people tested, about 20% of them confirmed positive. Okay? 5,784 deaths attributed. Although, there are some of those deaths are attributed to not necessarily the coronaviruses, but to complications that arose out of the coronavirus because they were immunocompromised or had underlying health problems. 32,649 cumulative hospitalizations. There's 3,917 hospitals in the United States with a total of 745,957 staffed beds. Okay? So, we have 1.2 million tested. We have 239,000 positive cases. We have 32,000 of those hospitalized, but we have 745,957 beds. Now, here's the question. What number of those beds are currently in use for non-coronavirus patients, and where are we in terms of capacity? Now, if you go to New York City, we're obviously overwhelmed in terms of capacity. That's why they have to have a Navy ship off the coast. But if you go to Minot, South Dakota, you're not overwhelmed in capacity. So you see how there's a difference in how this situation is unfolded in various different places. And there are reasons for that. In New York, it's the most densely populated city in America. So people are much closer together and come into much closer contact with each other on a daily basis. Imagine being quarantined in your 500 square foot apartment using the same ventilation system as everybody else in the building, touching the same stair rails, touching the same elevator buttons because you're on the fifth floor. Imagine how when you need to go out and get groceries, you have to touch those buttons and touch those chair rails and touch those doors. How can you possibly stay away from somebody even if you're quarantined in your own house? When you got to go on the subway, and I saw pictures from the subway yesterday, and it was jam-packed. How do you stay away from it in those cases? So there's mitigating circumstances in certain areas of the country where we should have an entirely different type of reaction to this than we should in other parts of the country. Some other interesting numbers that he sent me Of the 32,649 hospitalized, 21,000 of those almost have been in New York. So 64% of the people hospitalized have been in New York City. Could that have to do with the fact that it's a major metropolitan area? There's additional pollution there. That causes people with lung problems. You got a lung disease, lung-associated disease here, or a respiratory-associated disease. Could that be why the reaction in New York is a little bit higher? Just asking the question. New York has a total of 57,000 beds staffed. So that means that right now, about half of those are being taken by corona patients. That's a serious problem in New York. But again, you go to another place in America and it may not be a serious problem at all. Earlier, we talked to my friend Mike Sixkiller on the Navajo Reservation. They have small hospital facilities. So for them, in a community, when you have 10 people with coronavirus, if five of them have to be hospitalized, that's a really big freaking deal because of the size and capacity of the hospital. So how are we planning over the next month to get those hospitals in those areas extra beds, extra equipment, extra PPE? That should be the number one focus, because what you got to look at here is that if we keep closed down, we're all going to die anyway. So save the economy by preparing for how are we going to let people out and let them know this is a virus that doesn't kill very many people. They've revised the number now, and it's down to 0.066%. That's still about three times as deadly as a really bad flu season. But in terms of actual numbers, it's not that much. It's less than a percent of people. We're bringing our economy to a screeching halt and potentially destroying our republic over a sickness that kills less than 1% of the people it infects. I'm not trying to minimize the disease, and I'm not trying to minimize people who have it, the suffering and pain that they go through. I'm just pointing out the numbers. And remember, where are all these socialists who talk about the greater common good anyway? I mean, I'm just pointing that out. Some other numbers. States with large numbers of positive cases. New Jersey has 25,000. Michigan has 11,000. California, 10,000. I think it's interesting that California is on one of the most severe lockdowns in the country, and they have less cases than Michigan. Louisiana has 9,000. Florida, 9,000. Illinois, 7,600. Pennsylvania, 7,000. Washington State now has 6,500. That's where one of the hotspots was early on, and now they seem to be trailing down. That means that just nine states account for 74% of all of the positive cases in the U.S. That's interesting. One other point that my friend sent to me to consider, no way a predictive national analysis can be made or taken seriously when states are not testing in the same manner or at the same rate. For instance, some states like Kentucky, they're only testing those at high risk and some essential workers, which explains why Kentucky numbers are lower than surrounding states. Governor McDreamy won't let you drive to Tennessee because they have higher numbers of cases in Tennessee. But the governor of Tennessee the other day struck back at Governor McDreamy and said, well, we test our citizens at three times a higher rate. That's why we have more cases. In other words, there's more cases in Kentucky than you're showing. We just test more people here. So Governor McDreamy's not testing enough people. Now, maybe that's not his fault, and I'm not trying to lay that at his feet. We have to understand that there's probably thousands more cases in Kentucky than we know about. But the point is, that's actually a good thing because it shows that the vast majority of people have this and don't even know it, or have it and barely know it and never really get that sick. So I think that's interesting. But anyway, for instance, some states like Kentucky only testing high-risk people, lower the numbers than the surrounding states. In statistical analysis terms, the population samples are not the same, so the data we're getting is skewed. See, this is another important point. If Colorado is testing people differently and at a different rate than Kentucky is, and Texas is testing people at a different rate than New York is, then we're taking all the numbers and results that we get from those tests, and we're saying that it equates to a national poll. It's like if you had a really bad sample, like you went to Texas and you only polled Democrats, and it showed that Trump was going to lose re-election. You went to New Mexico and you only polled Republicans, and the rest of the country, you went and said that you only polled Republicans, then it would say that Trump was going to win in an overwhelming manner, right? Because you just polled Republicans in all the states but Texas, and you tried to use that as the national poll. That's what we're doing with these numbers here. What we're actually doing with these numbers is we're taking skewed samples in each different state, because every state has a different way of testing. Which, by the way, this is another failure of our leadership, because they should have been prepared for this. Every state has a different way of testing this. So we're basing our models in the country based on all these different ways of testing. We have no idea what that testing is actually telling us in terms of what this virus is actually doing in our population. Fascinating, right? I wanted to bring this one up, too. This comes from the Washington Post. Experts and Trump's advisors doubt White House's $240,000 coronavirus death estimate. This is from the Washington Post. Leading disaster forecasters, whose research the White House used to conclude 100,000 to 240,000 people will die nationwide from the coronavirus, were mystified when they saw the administration's projection this week. The experts said they don't challenge the numbers' validity, but they don't know how the White House arrived at them. The COVID-19 tracker, White House officials have refused to explain how they generated that figure. The death toll bigger than the United States suffered in the Vietnam War. They have not provided the underlying data so others can assess its reliability or provided long-term strategies to lower the death count. Some of President Trump's top advisors have expressed doubts about the estimate. According to the Washington Post, according to three White House officials who spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly, they have been fierce debates inside the White House about its accuracy. Here's what happened. I'm just going to tell you what happened. The president tried to open up for business, and the media went, "No, you kill people." That's what they did. So the president was like, "Ah, crap, I can't win with this." So the president says, here's the way we're going to do it. We're going to overestimate the number of people who die, and then when we don't lose that many people, we'll come out and do a victory lap. That's what's happening here. The media drove us to this place. I mean, Trump's responsible for his own actions, but I'm just saying the media drove us to this place. The president was probably seeing trends that showed that by April 15th, we can probably start to reopen the country, right? We'll probably have enough hand sanitizer. We'll probably have enough PPE. We'll probably have enough P95 masks. We'll probably have enough respirators. We'll probably have enough beds. We'll probably be in a good place where we can let young, healthy people back out. But the media ain't about to let that happen. The media needs death, destruction, and economic turmoil in that order. That's what they're looking for. And so the president recognized, probably rightly, that he can't win this battle. If he opens up the country, he gets blamed for every death that goes beyond that. And there will be deaths beyond the point that we open the country up. There'll have to be. We're even being told there's a 12 to 2 week time lag when we get a number of cases. Like when let's say the state of Kentucky says today there's 700 cases in the state. We're 12 days behind where we actually are. Because the data still, it takes so many days for the disease to incubate, then it takes so many days to go through the sickness, then it takes so many days for it to shed. So we're like 2 weeks behind where we actually are when we see the numbers, right? So if we're winning this, we're going to be winning this 2 weeks before we can actually open up the country. And when we do open up the country, we'll still be 2 weeks behind. So there'll still be deaths that come after that. And the mainstream media will blame every politician that opens their state up. So that's what the White House did. The White House said, well, make a number up, make it really big, make it so we know we won't actually get to that number. And then when we only lose 50,000 people nationwide, which, by the way, is on par with the flu, we had lost 61,000 Americans from October to March 1st to the flu. So when we come in at 50,000, then the president can do a victory lap and say, see, look at how many lives I saved. It's actually a bold move. But it's contributing to the lack of real, hard, solid information we have about this virus. So I just wanted to make that point. One other stat worth looking at is the ratio of confirmed positive to the number of people tested, which is less than 20%. Well, the same argument could be made about inconsistent population samples. The current ratio is still significant in that only those sick showing symptoms or exposed have been tested. If the tests were given to anyone who requested, including those not exposed and not showing symptoms, then the ratio and percentage of negative results would understandably be higher. But considering that the qualifications for testing, the fact that only 18.8% have been confirmed is positive, is noteworthy. That is a very good point. So we know that the only people getting tested are people, like, for instance, in Kentucky that are potentially vulnerable to this virus. And we know that, or essential workers, so we know that the vast majority of the population is not being tested. If everybody could walk in and get a test today, and it showed, you know, yes, you have it, or no, you don't have it, then you would probably have a much lower percentage of people who test positive and a much higher percentage of people who test negative. You would also have higher numbers of people who test positive overall, because I think a lot more people have this than we know. You may have already had it. I've had a lot of people that have texted me or emailed me and said, hey, I had something really weird in December. I went to the doctor. They said they called it a flu-like virus, flu-like illness, but they said it was negative for the flu. There's a lot of really strong, compelling anecdotal evidence that this thing was floating around the United States in December and January. And because we had a higher number than usual of flu-related cases or flu-like illnesses that didn't test out as the flu. So early on, before we knew that this thing was coming out, we thought that it was just a more intense flu season, and now it looks like we got a double whammy of two different viruses going around at the same time. All right. So the point that I'm making in all of this is what? Not that we shouldn't have social distanced. Not that we shouldn't continue social distancing. But rather that there's a lot of information out there that is contradictory. And there's a lot of information out there that to me appears to be information that is used to cover politicians' hide because the media is feeding the panic. What I want to know is the real truth about this virus. If what I suspect is true, and that is that the mortality rate is somewhere between, say, 0.5 and 0.66, or 0.066, 0.05 and 0.066%, meaning 0.5% to 0.67%. And that we can track that the vast majority of those deaths, those mortalities, are in vulnerable populations of the United States. Then we can look at this the way we do the flu and say, you know what? There's a chance you might get sick. There's a faraway chance that being sick might die. And you might ask yourself, how's that different than any other day in our life, right? Maybe it's slightly more, but how's that different than any other day of our life? There's a chance you get hit by a bus. Let's protect that vulnerable population, and let's let everybody else get back to business. So once again, let me give you this pointed breakdown, because I'm going to get accused of not caring about life and only caring about my wallet. I care about everybody's wallet. And I care about what everybody's wallet means to their ability to live their life as a free citizen of the United States. We need to have benchmarks. There must be something in place that says, if we reach these benchmarks by May 1st, we're going to reopen this portion of the economy. And if we reach these benchmarks by this date, we're going to reopen this portion of the economy, and so on and so forth. What that does is that translates to hope. People can begin planning for things they'll do this summer. Businesses can begin saying, all right, we have this much money left. These are the investments we can make. Let's rehire our people on this date. It gives us a sense of hope. And if we don't reach those benchmarks, there's nothing wrong with pushing them back. But you've got to set it. Visionary leaders have got to set visionary goals. This is vital. So I'm not saying release everybody today. That's not what I'm saying. And even as I speak, I'm getting hateful emails and comments on Facebook accusing me of not taking this virus seriously enough. And that's ridiculous. I got a tweet from somebody. They said, you care more about your money than people suffering a horrible death because our healthcare facilities become overwhelmed. I'll be glad to chip in a few bucks to you since it seems like your overriding concern is your bank account. This is a response that I wrote. I love how bringing up the looming economic disaster has people throwing out statements and accusations like this. Are we all 100% certain that the government is handling this 100% the right way? I mean, really? Well, just look at the mask thing, right? Originally, they told us we were stupid for wearing masks when, in fact, we might have been spreading this disease amongst each other. Now they're telling us we should wear masks. Beyond that, caring about the economy doesn't mean you only care about your wallet. Fact is, I care about this woman's economy, and I care about her life, and I want her to be able to live it in a way that she sees fit, not broke and penniless and homeless because she couldn't pay her rent or her mortgage. Does valuing people's ability to have a roof over their heads mean I only care about my wallet? Give me a break. Do people even understand how a collapsed economy will lead to way more deaths than this virus is capable of? Imagine a world where 40% of Americans are permanently out of work. Imagine the breakdown of society when poverty is that rampant. Imagine the rise in crime and violence and unrest. Imagine the number of people who will die too soon because being unemployed, they got broke and they lost their health insurance. Imagine all of the elderly whose only way to survive is their retirement, and that gets completely wiped out. Who's going to take care of them now? How will they live in comfort in their later years now? Is that the world that people want to live in, simply to avoid a virus that kills roughly 0.066% of the people it infects? Bringing up the economy is the caring, compassionate thing to do if you believe in personal freedom, if you believe in the American dream, if you believe in the American way of life, the good that America's wealth allows us to do for the rest of the world. I'm not going to apologize for choosing prosperity and freedom over living in the slums of a third world country simply because our only answer to this is to shut everything down and bury our heads in the sand. But hey, at least we got Netflix and Instagram, right? So long as the lights are on. Because who knows how long we'll continue having important services. So, all right, that was a bit of a rant. There was one other thing I wanted to point out on here. Again, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be social distancing. I'm saying that we need benchmarks. Those benchmarks, in my opinion, would be once employers have the ability to test their employees once a week and can give thermal tests every day. In other words, you walk in, take a quick temperature, you don't have a fever, go to work. Tested every single week. Once we have widespread cheap testing for everybody, which should be in a few weeks because there's companies working on it, if we can get the FDA out of the way. Once we have those in place, you can say to a business, hey, reopen your restaurant, but show us two things. Show us that you have the technology to test your employees weekly and daily, and show us how you're going to keep your customers 6 feet apart. Say to those businesses, you can now reopen. People can get their hair cut again. People can go to a restaurant again. People can do the basic services again. We can get that going again, all right? And once we have the capacity in our hospitals and the respirators and the staff to take care of what we know is going to be a slight influx of people vulnerable to this disease, then we can begin to start to let the rest of society out. You do a tapered, two-tiered, three-tiered, four-tiered, whatever you want to call it, reopening of the economy over time as you hit those benchmarks. You don't risk anyone's life doing that, and you save the economy at the same time. Like I said, I'm not saying we shouldn't be all social distancing right now, but here's a scary thought. The government, not just ours, but governments all over the world, now know the formula for getting the population to peacefully submit to an authoritarian police state. All you have to do is have a virus, real or not. I'm not saying this is not a real virus. This is clearly a real virus. But you wouldn't have to have a real one in the future. You could fake that, right? Wag the dog, anybody? All you have to have is a virus, real or not. And people will not only willingly submit, but they'll actually rat on their neighbors. And they will actually accuse people who question it of not caring about life. All right. Hey, look, I promise next week we're going to be way more positive. Actually, next week on the podcast, we're going to try to highlight some positive things. I've actually got a collection of stories of really big breakthroughs that are happening that are going to show us that there is light at the end of the tunnel. And we're going to talk about those as much as we can next week on the podcast. We're also going to do some non-coronavirus stuff next week because I think that's important. And we're also going to talk about the regulations that are holding back the fight against the coronavirus. Look, one more caveat. In 30 days, this entire podcast could be completely irrelevant. I'm going by the numbers that we have now. I'm going by my reaction to the politicians and what they're doing right now. If we don't have somebody in our leadership come forward with a visionary plan that says, if we reach these benchmarks, we can open up here. And again, be honest with the people. Well, we can take it. We can take it. If we don't reach those benchmarks, we have to move that date back to here, right? Those benchmarks are the benchmarks that save lives. I'm not talking about leaving people to die on the street here. I'm saying when we reach these benchmarks where we can assure we can save the most lives possible, then we can reopen. Leaving it open-ended the way it is, and even if we don't know when those benchmarks will be made, we have to start setting goals. When you get up in the morning and set a goal for your day, you don't know that you'll accomplish everything on the list, but you got to set the goal anyway so that you'll constantly strive and move towards that goal. America needs a rally point. We need a rally point. That's what I'm talking about here. You have to have a rally point. You can't just generally, generically say, oh, whenever the disease is beaten back and then we'll have the second wave. No, you have to have a rally point. When can we go back to work? How can we go back to work? And if we have to push the date back, we have to push the date back. But you have to at least give people a rally point. And if you give America a rally point, guess what we'll do? We'll rally. We will rally. If you give us a rally point, we'll rally. If you don't, we'll languish in our homes, we'll become desperate, crime will go up, violence will go up, unrest will follow, chaos will reign, the republic will fall. There you go. All right, next week, like I said, positive stories, how we're fighting this, how we're beating it back, plus some non-coronavirus stuff, and the five regulations that are keeping us from fighting this virus the most effective way that we can. Hey, thanks for listening. I am Leland Conway on the Disruption Zone. Thanks to my co-executive producer and co-host Cameron Mills. Thanks to Dynamics Audio Productions for their help with the production of this program. It's dxaudio.com. And the best thing you can do for us to expand our voice is to share this podcast. We're available on iHeartRadio's app. So now you can carry me around in your pocket. You can have it just beamed right to your phone. Also, Google Play and Apple Podcasts, Spreaker, and wherever podcasts are found, we are there. Just can't get away from the Disruption Zone. I'm Leland Conway. Thanks for listening.